This is an interview with Vern Cook at his office in Gresham, Oregon. The interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society is Clark Hansen. The date is June 22nd, 1995. And this is tape 17, side 1. I had a note here that I should start by asking you about Rose Gangle.
Well, that's an interesting place to start. In the 79 session, although I probably would have preferred to be the chair of the Tax and Revenue Committee again, for some reason, Bo, with his own agenda, decided to name me as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, which is a very important committee. And during my legislative career, I realized early, after my first year in the legislature, that if I were going to continue to be a lawyer as well as a legislator, one of the best places to kind of help a lawyer keep a little bit current is by being a member of the Judiciary Committee. Mm-hmm. Because not all legislation that is important to lawyers as a group will go through that committee, but a very large amount of it will. And so you get a great incidental benefit if you're going to keep practicing law, mm-hmm. by having been there. Mm-hmm. And I can't point to very much in the way of specific benefits. Maybe one case, one of my most important cases, that it wasn't because I was on the Judiciary Committee, come to think of it, it's because I was on another committee that I was helped by my experience there. But anyhow, being chair of the Judiciary Committee is an important committee, and my time wasn't wasted, and I didn't feel all that bad about it, being the chair. But there was a big change, for example, between when I first started in the legislature in 57 and by the time I was in my last session in 79. Part of this change was a result of the personality of Jason Bowe, who was would like to have been a dictator. I mean, I'm sure that was his true ambition, dictator. but he had dictatorial tendencies. He wanted to run everything. And so in the times when he was the president of the Senate, and he wasn't alone. There were others, I think, in the House. I think this session, for example, the House, this woman, Clarney, has some of the same bacteria infecting her. They get a little bit of power and they want to be all powerful. And so, whereas when I first was a legislator in the good old days, the chair of the committee would choose whoever, well, there weren't very many employees that were hired back in the late 50s and early 60s. We didn't have big staffs. Matter of fact, our secretaries were usually our wives or occasionally a husband if you had a woman legislator, and who worked right at our desk, and they had a community typing room. And the only staff that anyone had then is if you were the chairman of a committee, there'd usually be a secretary. And that secretary was not an administrative assistant. Now, that secretary was a secretary. Well, she was the nearest thing to an administrative assistant that you might have. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And if a lawyer were to be employed, and this is how I met Leo Levinson, really. In 59, I was on the House Judiciary Committee, and Bob Duncan, who was later the congressman, was the mm-hmm. chairman. No, he wasn't the chairman. He was the speaker, and he appointed Layman, a Republican, that's right, as the chair. That's how it was. And Layman, who was a bachelor, as was Leo Levinson, Layman was friends with Leo Levinson or knew him, so Layman hired Leo Levinson. I'm sure Layman didn't have to ask anybody about hiring Leo Levinson. The chairman, or the chairperson, had, as a matter of right, hired, if there was to be a legal counsel to be hired, they hired the legal counsel. Mm-hmm. If there was a secretary to be hired, they hired the secretary. If they did it because of patronage purposes, they could do that. Mm-hmm. When you get down in 79, the so-called professionalization of it, the chair ended up with someone that the president of the Senate chose for him. It's like having the Communist Party, the Comintern, deciding on who all the leadership people are. They weren't answerable to you. And so consequently, you didn't have their loyalty frequently. Mm. Bad. It was really a bad situation. I don't know if they still have it. It's a bad situation for a chairman of a committee not to have the loyalty of the chief administrative person there, because it hampers the way you can function. They often will be conspiring, you know, against you or working for someone else. You leave, you can't trust them. So in this case, the woman was the legal counsel, I think, is this woman who is the executive director for the state employees. You read about her every day. What the heck is her name? She's a state employee. You read on this big strike and so on. Goodman or something like that. She was the lawyer, and a competent lawyer, that Bo designated as the legal counsel to the Judiciary Committee. And the secretary, again, I didn't have any objection. Harriet somebody, had been the clerk of the Senate Judiciary Committee for 10 or 12 years, and competent, did a good job. Again, but she wasn't chosen necessarily by the chairman. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, what it turns out, we needed an assistant. And I got to hire the assistant. So I'd known this young woman named Rose Gangle. I think she'd been president of the student body at Gonzaga. It seems like I heard that. Mm. And very smart. Anything but a beauty. I mean, she had brains, but not beauty. And I'd known her in the Democratic Party, and we were friendly. She was a friend of Wally Priestley's, I'm sure. She told me one time, she said, yeah, she's a member of the whatever the gay organization was, although she denied that she was a lesbian. She called the town council then. Mm-hmm. She was a member of the organization, but she also had a great interest in battered women. And I can't remember if it was before or after that session, but she came out to our house on the Sandy and brought a contingent of battered women. And they all had a great time. They all got drunk, I remember it. Had a big party out there on the river. But Rose was the one that had a bill, and she asked me to sponsor it. Again, I don't know if my name, I think my name is attached to it. It was the bill, the domestic violence mm-hmm. bill. I'd say in a sense, in terms of its use and effect on people in this state, it's probably one of the most important bills that I've ever introduced. Mm. Because before that bill was introduced, whenever you heard of a situation where a woman was concerned about her husband beating her up, and that was the typical scenario, you'd hear people talking about a peace bond. Well, that was an ineffective thing. I mean, it just really wasn't available. The only mechanism that was available where there were potentially any teeth in it to, you know, short of criminal prosecution, which usually didn't happen either, was if you wanted to be able to get an order preventing a man from beating his wife up or doing things like that, you'd have to file a suit for divorce or separate maintenance and then get the court to issue an injunction against the guy. Was the only available remedy as a practical matter, right, other than having someone else go out and beat him up just to keep him under control, which occasionally happened, I think. But this bill then provided the mechanism, which is still in place and has been changed somewhat, not much, provided the mechanism so that it isn't limited to women, but 95% of the people involved are women. It broadly involves in any situation where people live together in a conjugal relationship, married or unmarried. It now applies to brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers. And there are people out there beating their parents up as well as beating their kids up. Mm-hmm. And it allows a person with, and it's the only, and it's still one of the few things, it's still the same way, I think, it's about one of the few legal remedies available that has no filing fee. You don't have to have a nickel to file. You don't even have to go in and take an oath of poverty. You can, it can be filed without any filing fee whatsoever.
Yeah.
A petition for the issuance of a restraining order or whatever. Well, that was the bill that she had me introduce, and it was very important legislation.
In 1979.
In 1979. Mm-hmm. I was down just the other day on what we call a call of cases, where the cases are ready, and I had a case that was going to be assigned out. And about 20 lawyers in the Judge Baker's room. I don't get there very often, but I was there, and she was talking to most of these lawyers. It seems like they're there every day, I guess. I just occasionally get down there, and they're all like, it was all buddies, and they're asking about everybody else's wedding and gossiping and all that garbage. But anyhow, and she said, "Well, now, how are we going to do with all these DVs?" So I asked the woman lawyers there, "What do they mean by DVs?" Domestic violence. So they have great volumes of them. I mean, it's a big part. I mean, nobody makes much money on them, usually, but it's a large part of the more or less criminal practice, because you get these domestic violence injunctions issued, and then the guy comes in, and it's got some teeth in it now. As soon as that order is issued in a domestic violence case, they put it on the computer. And then if the guy comes in, after it's on the computer, the guy comes in to pound on the door and shout at his wife or scream at her or threaten her. If she calls 911, the head of a cop comes right out and they pick him up and take him down to jail.
Wow.
Without even a buyer leave. Pretty effective remedy.
Huh. Huh.
So, but I wonder how many hundreds. I'll bet since that's been adopted, I'll bet it's up in the thousands. The cases that have been filed, domestic violence cases. So anyhow, that was, if I hadn't put it in, she probably would have got someone else to put it in, but I hired her as the assistant secretary. She was very competent. And as a matter of fact, she was attending law school, and then something happened. She died. She just dropped dead.
Really?
As a young woman.
You don't know what it was?
I don't know what it was. Oh. I never did find out. Hmm. Anyhow, so that's the story about Rose Gangle and the important legislation that I introduced.
It's still on the books.
Oh yeah, it's still on the books. There's been some slight changes, but I don't think they're significant.
Uh-huh.
Strengthened it probably, and you know, and you get legislation in, they're often shortcomings or that develop, and you realize it, and another session comes along and they make more changes. Mm-hmm. What's really kind of, when you hear about, there's all this business of these two legislators and Clarney and this black legislator, or one of the Avo Gordy or something. I wonder what in the world they're doing. You know, what more they can do, really, beyond that. I mean, they're making a lot of noise, but I doubt that it's going to make much difference, because that legislation is in place, and it's going to be hard to add much to it, really, because it's a pretty effective instrument, mm-hmm. tool by itself.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, I don't know who actually drafted it. I don't know if Rose drafted it, or if she got someone else to draft it, or who did it.
In a case like that, does legislative counsel?
She might have had legislative counsel draft it, and it seems to me like it was in pretty good shape when she brought it in.
Mm-hmm.
And now, incidentally, in those days, and I'm sure it's true now, I don't know what their present rules are in the legislature, but the committee chairman had a lot of influence in this way. If the committee chairman wanted to be effective and get things done, and wasn't too concerned about trying to bandy his own name around, the most effective way to start a bill off in those days was not just put in a bill jointly sponsored by Cook and Jones or something, but put it in as a committee bill. It had the prestige of the committee. It had the psychological advantage of Benjamin Franklin spoke of it when he had a proposal he was going to make. This is from his autobiography, I think, which you've probably read. If you haven't, you should. It's a very good short book, Benjamin Franklin's autobiography. Benjamin Franklin said, you know, he says, whenever I have a proposal, I never come up and propose it as my own. I will come up and say, a group of the more prominent men in the community have suggested. That would be a good idea to have this. And therefore, he said, I'm not the target. That's not us against Ben Franklin. I get it all away from him. And And it's just this anonymous neutral sort of thing out there.
So how do you get a bill, a committee bill introduced?
Well, depends upon how autocratic you want to be or feel like. And lots of committee bills are put in just the chairman puts it in. Technically, probably there should be a vote of the committee to introduce it as a committee bill.
I would think so, yeah. But that doesn't have to be.
Well, no, if they put it in, usually no one ever argues about it. Mm. You know, that's the way with power. You realize that the president of the Senate, like Bo, and the chair of a committee has really a lot of power. You can do a lot of things. You can do things that they may not be strictly in accordance with the rules, but they work. No one ever challenges it or questions it. I'm sure when Tom Mahoney was chairman of the committee, there were a lot of bills went in that were this committee bills that nobody voted on.
Would a chair of a committee, if he sees some problem with legislation he's dealing with or something that isn't coming through that he would like to see come through on some issue, can he introduce something, have the speaker sign or the president sign it?
Absolutely. The committee can request it to be drafted and put it in as a committee bill. And there are bills that that are originate when the members of the committee or the chair think, well, we need a bill on this and there isn't one here if it's early enough in the session. And you have a bill drafted and put it in as a committee bill. The other way, as I say, sometimes there'll be ideas come in and they'll ask you to put, if they really are more interested in getting the bill passed than in the notoriety of sponsoring it, they sometimes want it put in as a committee bill. And I felt, you know, there's one of the unfair attacks that were made against people, and I think in me also, that I often worked that way. I would put things in as committee bills, or I'd work on someone else's bill. And I would be very effective, but my name didn't appear, so therefore I got no credit for it. But I got it accomplished, and I self-satisfaction at least. And that is the way. That was the way it was, and it's probably still that way. And I imagine they still have committee bills. But it's a big advantage.
Is there an abuse of doing that as well?
I'm sure there are slight abuses, but they have to get enough votes in the committee to get them out anyhow.
Right.
And so there's a control on it. Committee bill or no committee bill, unless it gets the approval of a majority of the committee, it won't get to the floor, it didn't used to.
But for instance, if a speaker or a president is trying to get certain information, a certain bill through the legislature as quickly as possible, can he just assign it to the speaker's committee or the state and federal affairs, that kind of thing, and just get it right out like that? And
that was common with every president, and every speaker probably does that. Some of them abuse it worse than others. Yeah, they'd have, unfortunately, it's not really a very democratic system. When you get into that, they have their own, like Deb Spots used to be chairman of the State and Federal Affairs Committee, and Bo would stack, as Boyven did before, they'd stack that committee with all their buddies, and so if they sent a bill to that committee, and it would just go out like that.
Really?
With or without hearings, yeah. Or they wanted it killed, get a bill in, they'd send it to that committee and never see the light of day, never get out of committee.
But they could get a bill through the committee without hearings?
Oh, yeah.
How would they do that? I thought they...
Well, there's no law, no rule. Actually, there's no rule, or never used to be, probably still isn't, in the legislature. It says you have to give any bill a hearing. There's nothing in the rules about having to give hearings.
Do bills have to go through committees to go to the floor?
Well, they don't really have to. Now, there are ways you can avoid it. It would be occasionally as possible for... generally, they are referred to committee, but I couldn't give you an instance, but I've known during the time I was there a time or two when a bill just basically got to the floor without ever having been heard in committee. It's rare, but the rules would permit it. You'd probably have to suspend the rules a couple of times to do it. But if the president or the speaker has things wired well enough, he can get away with that. Again, the position is they can do whatever they're big enough to do lots of times. And so they have tremendous power. And here, you know, the thing that I read of, and it seemed almost unheard of to me, what was it? I think it was the Senate president, by edict, took a bill away from the committee. I don't think that could ever be done. I don't think the rules permit that. I don't know. He just did it because he's big enough to do it. Nobody was wanting to fight with him. But I don't think that the president of the Senate, the speaker of the House, has the right to say, okay, bring this bill out.
Right. Well, you were in a situation where they took the chairmanship away from
you. Yeah, and that was questionable, whether he really had the right to do it. But again, he had the votes. Yeah, Boe removed me as chairman of the Senate committee. He had the authority under the rules to name me as chairman. The question was, did he have the authority under the rules to remove me as chairman? Yeah. Well, he did. And no one challenged him. Uh-huh. And I didn't, probably for a very good reason. It would have been an exercise in futility. And as it turned out, the way it happened was the best way anyhow, as it turned out, you know. I mean, it was a very awful thing. I mean, I was very crushed when that happened. I remember McPherson, what's his name?
Hector McPherson?
Not Hector, the other one.
Gordon McPherson?
Gordon McPherson. Yeah, when Boe removed me as chairman of the Senate committee, that was in 73, there was a, they were having a social event in which all the legislators and their staff were invited that night. I think, the night that I was removed. So I saw Gordon McPherson, and he came up to me. He was friendly to me. I'd been friendly with him. And I started saying to him, and I accused Boe of being everything but a Christian gentleman. And when it was all done, Gordon said, "Vern," I said, "that's fine. I can understand your feeling," he said. "Well, I'm glad you said it to me. Don't say it anywhere else." And I didn't. It was good advice. But I got it off of my chest, and fortunately to someone who was friendly to me and a friend at the time.
Right.
And it didn't hurt me.
Yeah.
Nice that it happened that way. Now, I don't see him much anymore. I don't know how he's one of those legislative friends. The friendship didn't survive this session, you know.
Right.
You don't see him. He married he divorced his wife and married one of the committee clerks, I think. I don't know if they're still married or not.
Well, going on to some of these issues of the 79th session.
Yeah.
I'm not sure there are a lot here, but I'm not sure how many things you were actually involved with. There was a state payment of 30% of a homeowner's property taxes and granting of a 9% income tax refund that was passed. Would that have gone through your revenue
committee? No, I was on the revenue committee, and it might have, or it might have gone through Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure which it would have been.
Mm-hmm.
I was on the revenue committee.
Right. That was being chaired by Powell.
Yeah. Who's still a lobbyist down there, incidentally.
Is that right?
I was down there this session. I saw him a couple of times. He voluntarily left the Senate and took a job as a lobbyist, and has been there ever since.
He's from the Eugene area?
He was from Albany.
Albany.
Originally. I don't know where he's from now.
Well, there was also a revision of the state welfare system to deny benefits to two-parent families in which both parents are able to work.
I don't remember particularly that legislation, but it sounds familiar.
And there was a $16.1 million dollar appropriation for the Banfield Light Rail. Was this just the beginning of the light rail funding and in 1979?
I think it was the beginning, and I was one of the few people that voted against it.
Really? Why?
I still think I was right. That thing, I'll bet, is the biggest boondoggle for the wealthiest people in Portland that has ever been through the legislature.
How so?
Because it funnels these people into downtown Portland, where all that very valuable industrial property is. And that's why there's always that big push for that. They want that light rail down there. At the time I compared it to the light rail, it was not really bad in the sense it reminded me of ancient Rome. In ancient Rome, the wealthy Romans built temples to Zeus. if you were anybody in Rome, you built a temple to Zeus. Why? That was really pretty good because it kept all the ordinary Romans working. The light rail was our temple to Zeus. And so they benefit by all this stuff being coming right into downtown Portland. It's one of those businesses, you know, a guy says, I'm losing $5 on every hat, but I'm going to make it up on volume. And the plan was they run that light rail right out down through the center of already developed area of Portland. And at the time I thought, if you're really concerned about reducing the traffic from the suburbs, you take the money you use for that light rail and build a whole series of apartments over on the west side somewhere. You could house five times as many for one-fifth of the cost. Hmm. But if you really wanted to have a light rail, there was another track, and that track ran out by the Oaks Park, came right out to Gresham and swung around this way. The more sensible plan would have been the Cook plan, finally getting to it. Run it out where there aren't any developments. There's hardly any houses there at all. There were then lots of empty fields, with the idea of running out and put houses all along there and develop it as a place for people to live. It would have been a whole lot less expensive in terms of land acquisition. You would not have disturbed neighborhoods the way it actually ended up. If you just notice the path, most of the path there is already developed. Now, I notice now, I just happened to be in a restaurant the other day, overheard some guy saying, well, I'm building more apartment houses along the freeway, something. There's a lot of building now. That's where it should be. Mm-hmm. But the thing that was wrong with the plan is it ran it out through already existing area, which was very expensive. And if they really were honest and really if they were concerned about providing a place for people to live where they'd use the light rail, they'd run it out in an area where there wasn't development. Mm-hmm. Probably the wealthy people in Portland didn't own that land out there. They barely owned it over here. So anyhow, and I actually arranged during that session with my legislative assistant, we arranged to have the people from the traction company, we took a ride out that line. Well, no one was interested because I didn't... the wealthy people didn't have that in mind. That's my thing. Mm. And here's Goldschmidt, that hypocritical son of a bitch. He helps kill the light rail. He helps kill the Mount Hood Freeway because it was disturbing neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And yet the light rail goes right square through I don't know how many neighborhoods.
But isn't the rationale that it takes up less space and therefore isn't as disruptive as... they brought it essentially here. They brought it down... Well, Burnside.
Brought it down through that in an area in downtown Portland. There, down Sullivan's Gulch.
Sullivan's Gulch.
How far could it follow Sullivan's Gulch?
Well, it went all the way out to I-205.
Did it get that far on Sullivan's Gulch?
Along the railway there, along.
Yeah, maybe along Sullivan's Gulch, and then once it got out of the gulch, so that was developed. Completely developed. Yeah. A deal there.
So but that wasn't until you got to 205.
Maybe not. Where
it bends over and then goes up Burnside. Then over here it's Division, isn't it?
I think of it when you go here. Now, if you go from Gresham, there is a stretch down here that wasn't developed very much between Division and Burnside, about 187th. Then from about 187th all the way down to Montevilla, all the way down to 82nd, it was all developed. Mm-hmm. I don't think there were hardly any vacant land. There was hardly any vacant land in that whole stretch from roughly 187th, which is near the Rockwood Clinic for Burl Works, all the way down to, I'll bet it was close to 50th. Mm. Now, wherever Sullivan Gulch ends, from there on out, I haven't seen any figures, and I never interested myself to try to find out about it, but I'll bet the acquisition costs were horrendous for the land and so on. And I'll bet the available land for building things to take advantage of it down in there, there wasn't a lot. They had to tear everything else down in order to put up those things, if they put up apartment houses. Mm-hmm. Now, when you get out here, once you get out to Gresham, this part out here wasn't built up, so there's a long... as you know, right out by the Cleveland station, there's a bunch of apartment houses there. It's a logical place for them. It's a good place for people that have been convicted of drunk driving who have jobs in downtown Portland to get in one of those apartments. Because they can go right down and back.
Sure.
Well, anyhow, I opposed it because I thought it was put in the wrong place. And it was very expensive. But again, I guess